that number, a million pounds, and you can correct me on that one. So with their current orbit and its rate of decay, I think you're saying they're good for 10 years. So worrying about further boosting doesn't seem to be a problem. When the space shuttle used to go up, I think the amount of excess fuel was nowhere near as much. So each space shuttle boost, I'm guessing, was much smaller. Therefore, as the space shuttles used to visit, I'm guessing almost every one of them did a small amount of boosting. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, that's true. A small boost with the shuttle. Bigger boost. And yeah, 1 million pounds, you're right. The estimate on the weight of the base station. And that's going to be good until, what, 2024. And then by then, the Russians are thinking about building a new space station. And they, in fact, before they deorbit the International Space Station, they want to disconnect a couple of their modules and use it for their new space station. I mean, they've got long-distance plans. They love space stations. And talking about numbers, and at the beginning of the night, you always say, we've got to make corrections. And I made a statement, it was last week, I think it was last week, about the distance between the pads on the LEM. Well, I'm off by about 5 or 6 feet. I'm saying I think it was 37 feet, and it's 31 feet. 31 feet, so. I think when your eyes start going, the one start to look like seven. But it's close enough. It's still a big thing. 31 feet. It's pretty far from one pad to the other on the LEM. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
And I think that diagonal distance across the square of the four pads, and a portion of my living room is 22 feet long end to end. 31 feet. Wow. That is a big vehicle. And a dangerous maneuver. Everything's got to go right. That engine that brings them back off the surface, you only get one attempt to fire it. It's got to go or it's game over. Those engines that allow you to land, they've all got to fire exactly right, and none of them go into any kind of a haywire mode. Otherwise, you crash into the moon's surface. And just like Wesley was telling us last week, the moon's temperature from day to night does go to numbers like plus 100 degrees centigrade above what we like, and minus 100 degrees centigrade from what we like, just from day to night. So let me jump. It rolls off the tongue real easily. We're gonna put a group of people on the moon and let them live there for a while. Oh, really? How are they gonna live with those intense hot temperatures at high noon, and those intense temperatures that are much colder than we've got in any place on Earth at night? And the same thing with Mars. Mars has got intense cold temperatures at night. And the Mars day is not that different from an Earth day. And you don't have a nice warm breeze blowing by you. And you've got an atmosphere that's almost pure carbon dioxide and very little atmosphere at all. How in the world do you survive in that environment? So to send a colony to the moon or a colony to Mars sounds nice and simple. Even Buzz Aldrin said, why don't we go do that? I don't think he has looked. Let me drop. I don't think he's looked into the specifics of just temperature and lack of air that you've got to survive, and living in a spacesuit continuously. Where do you set up a habitat that can tolerate those temperature extremes? Where's the fuel going to come from to keep it warm at night, and to use some intense air conditioning in the day to keep you from roasting in that oven? I have reason to believe there's not going to be a colony on Mars. There's not going to be a colony on the moon, or in my lifetime, maybe not even the lifetime of our children. I know that Wes had a further question or comment, and then I'm going to tell you about this beautiful breakthrough that was made by high school students that found something that no one had ever seen before when it comes to pulsar discoveries. WS2N, N2XJN, K2RAW, go with your question, Wes.
Let's see, as a comment. You know,
temperature drop is limited by conduction of heat from layers several meters below surface of our closest planet. If we think about lunar existence of the lunar colonies, we could think about them being below the surface and not much below the surface. By Stefan Boltzmann law, you could have a temperature of 23-24 degrees of Celsius constantly. And that would be somewhere at equator. So that's one comment.
Yeah, let me stop you right there. If you had that habitat below the surface, did all that digging, did all that construction, and you got that habitat below the surface, yes, the temperature is a lot more steady, but you got a chicken and egg problem. How do you get the machinery and people to survive those extreme temperatures while you're digging that hole and constructing that habitat? Once it's there, you stand a chance. Getting it there is one hell of an engineering challenge as I see it. Over to US, K2RAW.
I read the same thing that guy that Wesley read. Yeah, they could do it.
You got to understand one thing. Nearby equator, you have a certain part, so you have like 8 hours or 12 hours of temperature, and there is a misunderstanding. A 24 degrees of Celsius is approximately 80-85, I believe, in Fahrenheit. So it's extremely comfortable temperature. So when the temperature rises up or goes too much down, they go down. They go below the surface. Enter here.
I admit that being below the surface, you have much more steady temperature. You're out of some of the wicked cosmic rays. All that material above you will give you a lot of protection from both temperature, cosmic rays, solar wind, and so on. But establishing that, I mean, look at the volume of the International Space Station. To have that much volume as a habitat below the surface of the moon would be awfully nice. And I can estimate how long it would take to dig all of that structure and establish it.
I'm gonna dig it. Actually, one of the things is seen, I don't have the source in front of me. It's an explosive. So you have two sets of explosives. One set of explosives that actually will make a big hole where the ready-to-use shelter will be buried. Then the second set of the explosives from left and right would just do the burying of that shelter. So that could be done extremely nice. You know, we have had a number of buildings that were pretty nicely demolished. I don't know about 9/11, whatever. Now, another thing is the progress. The Russian progress that is malfunctioned is expected to go down to the Earth at 9 of May, which is the victory day for the Russia over the Germany. Interesting.
Go ahead, John.
Well, Dick, as you realize, even if you use explosives, you need massive machinery to move the muck. That's from the explosives. That's how they do it here. So either way, it's a problem.
You think they have these lava tubes they want to live in. That's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, by explosives, you can make a pretty big hole in the ground. And you can install a habitat there and hope that you don't get a high noon during that procedure, which melts down all your hardware. And then by some kind of machinery, you've got to now pour the dirt back on top And we're talking about moving a lot of dirt, a lot of lunar soil. Not easy. Doable, yes. At a tremendous cost. And the American public and Congress is going to ask, what do I get in return? Yes, the backside of the moon is a beautiful place to put a radio telescope, an optical telescope. But getting it there, getting communication there, back to the Earth, a lot of stuff required, a tremendous amount of cost. I mean, each pound of hardware you bring to the lunar surface, I don't know what the number is, but with our best boosters right now, if it takes you $1,000 to put a pound into near-Earth orbit, what does it take to take a pound of hardware to the lunar surface? Are we talking more like $50,000 a pound? Make a guess on that one, Paul. Each pound of hardware you bring down to the lunar surface, you think it costs in dollars to a pound, in current dollars to get it there. That's a homework assignment for you, Paul. That's what you need, is more homework assignments. WS2N, K2RIW.
My problem is, the decades have passed, so the numbers I used to know have changed, but I think it's probably $10,000 a pound. And that's why Elon Musk, whatever the number is, he's going to drop two digits. He's going to take exponents. He's going to take two exponents off the number. He's going to drop it by, if it's 10,000, he'll make it for $100, you know, whatever it is. I mean, that's from reusability. We'll see where that goes. I'm in the middle of reading the book by Buzz Aldrin, Mission to Mars, and he has all that. He's got that all figured, but again, the infrastructure is tremendous. Orbiting satellites around the moon, and just for GPS purposes, I mean, to set that up is expensive. That's what he wants to do. Things in the Lagrange points, he wants that for communication back to Earth, operating equipment from there, robotically moving stuff around and setting things up on the moon when you don't even need people on the moon to do it. And also living in lava tubes. They believe there's these lava tubes, and so you don't even have to dig. You know, you can have almost a small city in these lava tubes that supposedly exist on the moon. Dig. Back to that.
You said it's now $10,000 a pound, and Musk thinks he can get it down to $100 a pound. Is that to get a pound of material into Earth orbit? There's a huge difference between price to get a pound into Earth orbit versus price to get a pound onto the moon. So I think those numbers were Earth orbit. Is that true? Up all the head?
Yeah, I always thought it was, what, 10,000 per pound for Earth orbit. The moon, I don't know. Put another two zeros on that. Back to you, Dick.
I think you're right on, Paul. I think it's another two zeros. If the current price is 10,000 to get a pound onto the moon, I mean, under Earth orbit, it might very well be $1 million a pound to get stuff onto the moon. So, I mean, all this machinery that's going to do the blasting and digging and recovering and establishing habitats and whatever, if by today's money it's in the vicinity of $1 million a pound to get it there, and we're talking about lots of tons of stuff, I don't think Congress is going to go for that, Paul. Not even with somebody as informed as you are explaining to them what they get in return. If the number to establish a colony on the moon is $1 trillion in current dollars, and it might be in that ballpark, you compare that to the $31 billion we spent on the Apollo program, and now you want to spend 30 times more than that, in my very rough approximation, to get a colony onto Mars, a Christian moon. And when a proxmire-like senator or congressman says, what do I get in return for that $1 trillion and all that list, all that risk to life and limb, what do I get in return? In the case of supporting NASA, which is something like $50 every man, woman, and child, $50 a year to support NASA. I spend a hell of a lot more than on just cat food. The average person spends more than that just on buying Starbucks coffee every week. That's one good Starbucks coffee per week, or maybe not even, once every 2 weeks. So it's small. We're getting our money's worth with NASA. But $1 trillion to put a colony on the moon. Do you think you can sell that one, Paul? WS2NK2RIW?
Think about putting a 20,000-pound backhoe on the moon, Dick.
The guy from Europe, John, yeah, John. Just thought of that. What, do you got a gold shovel on that? No, the guy from European Space Agency, the head of that now, he just came on. He's in charge of, you know, making plans, what they're going to do. He's pushing for a colony on the moon. I mean, that did actually just come out a couple of days ago. And he wants NASA to get involved with him. So let's see if he can sell this $1 trillion idea. But he's gone. How he wants something after the space station. He wants to do this. He's got big plans. I just read this. Back to you, Dick.
I'm doing a quick back of the envelope calculation as to how much that costs every man, woman, and child in the United States. That's a tough one to sell. Now let me give you this very good piece of good news. This report I'm about to read you is the May 1st issue of a report from National Radio Astronomy Observatory, Green Bank, West Virginia. And it's entitled, Pulsar with the Widest Orbit Ever Detected. Okay? So some scientist somewhere detected this beautiful pulsar that's twice as wide in orbit as they've ever seen before. About to ask, what is that scientist's name? And the article says, let me drop it.
Pulsar in orbit.
Yeah, it turns out that a very small number of the pulsars are in orbit around some other object. Another neutron star, another white dwarf, another solar mass. A certain percentage of the pulsars are in orbit around something else. And a very famous ham radio operator, the guy who invented the Joe Taylor, K1JT, Joe Taylor, got a Nobel Prize for using the telescope in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, to detect the Doppler variation of a pulsar, which represented the fact that it was going around another massive object. And therefore, as that pulsar approached you, you saw more pulses per second, positive Doppler shift. As it went away from you, you saw less pulses per second. He detected that orbit. He's the first one who did that. Joe Taylor did that. And he got the Nobel Prize for doing it. And you go to the right ham radio convention, and he will show you that Nobel Prize. He passes around that great big piece of gold that was once around his neck in Stockholm, Sweden. And he's a little bit careful about collecting it at the end of that pass around. I don't know why he does that. Let me drop. So he detected the first one. And now a scientist has detected one with a much wider orbit than any of the ones that Joe Taylor saw or all the people after him. I think Joe Taylor did that around 1990 or so. I'm not quite sure when he did it. He was working at Arecibo, Puerto Rico for a period of time as a visiting scientist from Princeton University when he made this discovery. Okay. A team of highly determined high school students discovered a never-before-seen pulsar by painstakingly analyzing data from the National Radio Astronomy, from the National Science Foundation's Robert C. Byrd Green Bank Telescope. That's that telescope that is 100 meters in diameter. It's 17 million pounds of hardware in Green Bank, West Virginia at the NRAO, National Radio Astronomy Observatory. I saw that under construction about 15 or so years ago. I was there when it was about half built. Beautiful piece of hardware. Imagine a radio telescope, fully steerable dish, made of 2,600 individual panels, where all the panels can be tuned to keep it accurate as a function of gravity, temperature, snow load, wind load, whatever. So a radio telescope that would normally go to 2,000 megacycles can go to more than 100,000 megahertz. 100 gigahertz this thing can go to by tuning itself. 100 meters in diameter, 2 acres of telescope reflecting surface, parabolic surface, that's fully movable. What a piece of hardware. Let me drop it.
How much gain does it have?
The numbers don't go for that big, Joe. I mean, there we go. Boom. Add each individual frequency. Gain, you can calculate that. Gain is...
Yeah, that was another guy.
Gain is 4 pi A over lambda squared. So you take the area, multiply it by 4 pi, divide by the wavelength that you're using, or multiply it by frequency squared, either one, and that is the gain as a hard number, and take decibels of that. Okay. The highest gain parabolic surface I knew about that about until now was the 200-inch Mount Palomar telescope, roughly 136 decibels of gain. Not because it is so huge, but because the wavelengths are so small. It's an optical telescope at a millionth of an inch of accuracy across that 200 inches of diameter. One really pristine piece of glass, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. Okay, this radio telescope runs at a million times lower frequency, a million times bigger wavelength, but still it'll have the maximum gain in theory at the 100 gigahertz, the maximum frequency where it operates. A lot of gain. We're talking about a radio telescope that has, I don't know the exact number, but a couple of seconds of arc of beam width. You got to very carefully aim this thing because call it a pencil beam is an oversight. Okay. Turns out the Green Bank Telescope has been gathering something like 17 terabytes of data. And these two high school students carefully analyzed that data with some computer programs as part of this program, which I'll explain to you. Let's see now. Opening round. Pulsars rapidly spinning. Let's see. That explains what a pulsar is. Some of the most extreme objects in the universe is what a pulsar is. Very few of them are in orbit around some other object that's so massive, but yet you can't see it. Only a rare few orbit other neutron stars or main sequence stars like our sun. The reason for this paucity is double neutron star systems, astronomers believe, is the process by which pulsars and old neutron stars form. So it's a rare event. Anyhow, this pulsar, which they give it a name, was discovered in 2012 by Cecilia McGaw, who was a student at Strasburg High School in Virginia at that time, and Mr. Shang Ray, who was a student at Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School in Baltimore, Maryland. These students were participating in a summer pulsar search collaboration, PSC they call it, workshop, which is a National Science Foundation-funded educational outreach program that involves interested high school students in analyzing pulsar survey data collected by the Green Bank Telescope. Students often spend weeks and months poring over data plots, searching for unique signature that identifies a pulsar. Those who identify strong pulsar candidates are invited to the Green Bank, West Virginia site to work with astronomers to confirm their discovery. So these are dedicated students, and each of these students in that period since then, because of this discovery of ours, have gone on to prestigious colleges. And so they're going to be doing great work in the future. Let me drop this. This pulsar that he discovered is 52 million kilometers away from the object it is in orbit around. That's roughly the distance between Mercury and the Sun. It's a brand new distance, more than twice they've ever seen before. It orbits once every 45 days. I think the one that Joe Taylor discovered, it took multiple years for it to make it orbit. But I'm not sure about that. But I know he measured the Doppler shift to confirm that it was in orbit, that pulsar was in orbit around something else. These students analyzed 130 terabytes of data produced by the 17 million pound Green Bank Telescope. Let's see, it's in the Pulsar Search Collaboratory, the joint project between, a joint project between NRAO and West Virginia University. So, these students did some great things. As I see it, high school students. The first pulsar going around something was dedicated effort using the Arecibo 1,000-foot diameter radio telescope in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, by Dr. Joe Taylor, K1JT. Here we are, a couple of decades later, where very dedicated high school students can do it. I mean, the amount of education that Joe had at the time he did it was significant. What would you pull for any comments? WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very well done. I haven't read that. Pulsar. First thing I heard of with detecting Doppler shift on the pulsars. They knew where the pulsar was, but they wanted to see if there were planets going around it. So they were able to detect the shift of the pulsar, you know, going back and forth as the planets progressed around the pulsar. And I think they found three planets, and that was the first planets ever found, extraterrestrial planets, extrasolar. And then after that, you know, the race was on. Eventually they found planets around the sun and this and that. But you're saying that these pulsars are in orbit around another dense object like a neutron star. That's different. Okay, Dick, back to you.
In the big picture, I can see some correlation here. Our sun is a unary object. In other words, it's all by itself. The majority of suns, majority of stars are binary star systems. A smaller percentage are unaries. Binaries are very popular. When a cloud of gas decides to come together, coalesce, and form stars, planets, binary stars are very popular. So in the case of a pulsar, which is a collapsed star that went into a supernova, and the nugget left over of material that didn't get blasted away, if it has enough mass to be a neutron star, is a relatively rare, I think. And then for a pair of them to happen side by side with this great distance between them, to explain the scenario as to how that happened, this article is telling you, is very difficult. And it was quite a surprise that this great distance between these two objects, these two very massive objects, let me drop this, was discovered. And when they look in that direction with optical telescopes, there is nothing to be seen. Whenever the massive object is going around, it's not a main sequence star, it's not a white dwarf, you'd be able to see those. So it appears to be a pair of neutron stars going around each other, very massive remnants of a supernova or a number of supernovas. And how you get the remnant of a pair of supernovas to join up with each other, that's a very difficult scenario to describe, to figure out how that happened. Or for one massive star to go into a supernova and form a pair of neutron stars, that's a difficult one, though. So where did this thing come from? It's a darn interesting question. And one of these neutron stars just happened to be a pulsar, which means it's got an axis of rotation that's strongly dispersed from the magnetic axis. And as that magnetic axis sweeps by us X number of times per second like a lighthouse, that's what's making the pulses that we see as a pulsar. And that object is in orbit around some other very heavy object. And high school students discovered that by pouring over 17 terabytes of data, probably using some pretty fancy programs, looking for a particular signature of a pulsar Doppler shift recognition, if you know what I mean. Anybody with any further questions on all of the above, give me your call letters right now and name K2RIW in the second end.
It's Roy Roy. I don't have a question on all of the above, but I have a question for you.
Fire away, Joe. You're number one on the runway right now.
Okay. Did you check your R7000 like you said you were going to do from last week?
I used to say the highest priority in the house is that the fluids must flow in and out of the house. And the second highest priority is things like electricity. All of a sudden, I've got a higher priority. The refrigerator decided to fail. And I have fallen in love with a certain style, a certain number of cubic feet and whatever. And I found out today that I'm having great trouble buying it. So replacing our refrigerator
and living with bags of ice so that all the food we own is not spoiling, that's taking a higher priority. No, I haven't measured my R7000 receiver to find out why it has low sensitivity and over what frequency range it's got. That's on my list, Paul, but for obvious reason, it hasn't bubbled to the top of the list. Demi2LYY, K2LIW.
Yes?
Okay, it was just a question.
Am I hearing, that sounds like Vito. Was that Vito I just heard?
Purple Zombies, Dick. I'm down the lab. I was just reading the mail. What's the story with the R7000?
I know for a fact that my R7000 is about 20 dB down in what it should be at sensitivity. I've got an advanced receiver research preamplifier in front of it, boosting all the signals it listens to, and therefore it behaves very well, and I'm using it right now. Joe is asking me to do is to find out, is it a lack of tracking of the RF amplifier that's making it low in sensitivity at certain frequencies and more normal sensitivity at other frequencies, or is it a damaged gas fed transistor that's making it low in sensitivity everywhere? And he's recommending that I take my 8640 Hewlett-Packard signal generator and sweep it across the band and measure its sensitivities at every 25 megs, from 25 megs to 2,000, and plot a graph and find out what it's doing. That's before I open up the cover and finding out, is it bad tracking or a bad transistor that Joe is suggesting could be the cause. I know you've repaired a number of R7000s with low sensitivity, and what's the most prevalent thing you've discovered, Hal? K16PZ, K2RIW?
Well, what I want to know is what segment of the areas have low sensitivity. Is it a continuous segment or different segments where you're having low sensitivity? First question, Dick, I have to ask you. Yeah, I know R7000s very well. I worked on maybe 35 of them over the last 10 years.
Yeah, your segment question is the question that Joe just asked me. Have I made the measurements to find out at what frequency / what segments is it low in sensitivity? I use it on 2 meters, I use it on 450 every single day. And on both of those bands, it appears to be 20 dB down in sensitivity. Where else down, what segments, I don't yet know. I haven't done that signal generator sensitivity measurement yet. It's on my list, hasn't bubbled to the top of the list yet. I found a way around it. Right now, it's not stopping my operation. Over to you, Hal. And of all of those 7,000 you've repaired, of the ones that were low in sensitivity, what's the number one reason, what's the number two reason you've seen of all those that you've repaired low in sensitivity? K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K6DPZ. Well, I found a lot of the diode switching and the filter networks being a big problem. But without telling me which area it's got a problem, I can't tell you if it's the diode networks and the switching at the front end, or if it's LO injection.
You get a peculiar characteristic of lousy dynamic range when your low, when your LO injection is down. LO injection means that the mixer has a hell of a lot more insertion loss, and the mixer saturates a hell of a lot easier. Low in sensitivity lowers the third order intercept point of the mixer, as well as drastically increasing its insertion loss. From all I can tell, I have seen no saturation characteristics on this thing. I had a 20 dB gain preamp in front of it. The sensitivity is normal. The strongest signals it can tolerate sound normal. I see no lack of dynamic range. So low LO injection isn't the top of my guess. As you can tell, I'm guessing damaged FET transistor and or, as you said, switching diode and or tracking function of the RF stages. Over to you with any other guesses as to what it could be with so little information. Over to you, Hal. K2RIW.
No, Dick, with this information you gave me, I really can't give you an immediate answer. I know which I'd go after, but I've worked on so many of them. I would go through because they're using different VCOs for injection and different amplifiers from the VCOs for injection. So you're not telling me what the spectrum is, where your main failure is. So without that, I can't give you a real deductive answer. If I had sitting in the front of me, made a few checks, then I could say what the deductive answer is. K2RIW, K6DPZ.
My R7000 was, for a considerable length of time, connected to a fairly low piece of coax cable that went to a 450 megacycle antenna that sat on the top of 100 feet of tower, that sat on the top of 300 foot land, and during that year or two that it was connected that way, lots of lightning storms occurred. So when it comes to a lightning impulse having entered that coax cable and entered the front end, very likely, and there was no protection there, no spark gap or whatever. So my first guess is that first FET transistor has been fried. But we'll still find out. Sometime in the next month or so, I'll get to making the measurements and or opening up the cabinet using my service manual and doing some probing and find out whether that an RF stage that's supposed to have 15 dB of gain has really got 20 dB of loss. Over to you, Hal. K6DBZ, K2RIW.
Okay, Jack. Well, you know, I can only give you so many answers with the information you're giving me. You got the manual, and you're intellectual enough to be able to interpret how to troubleshoot, so I don't have to take you by the hand.
Yeah, I used to have a lot of fun troubleshooting some pretty elaborate spectrum analyzers that went from 0 to 12.4 gigahertz that were being manufactured by Airborne Instruments Laboratory for, I guess, for about a four-year period of time. I was the engineering manager of spectrum analyzer products in another life. And boy, I saw some fancy troubleshooting. When you've got 100 dB of dynamic range and a logarithmic IF system with display and all kinds of digital signals flying around for frequency counting, amplitude counting, and so on, calibration, 78 pounds of hardware, 300 watts of input power, and a lot of stuff. A whole bunch of circulators, isolators, yig-tuned filters, yig-tuned oscillators, lots of a zillion operational amplifiers, a zillion chips of bipolar logic, making it all run right, track right, and so on. So, yeah, I've done some troubleshooting, as you have, and fun stuff. Divide and conquer is my usual way. I like signal tracing. Let me drop. To put a weak signal into the front end of, say, a receiver, and then by probing, look at how much stronger or weaker the signal gets on what frequency as it walks downrange stage to stage. As long as you have access to some test points on those stages, and I don't mean formally established test points. I mean, if there's a printed circuit board, you can touch the microstrip land or touch a nearby capacitor or inductor lead and sample the signal. And even an oscilloscope probe intended for a 100 megacycle oscilloscope, that as a probing device has a predictable amount of insertion loss, a predictable amount of loading if you're looking at a signal at 1 gigahertz. And there's ways around that to stop the loading, still couple some of the signal. Sometimes you have to homebrew probes, if you know the way, in order to do troubleshooting. Now, we've got 10 minutes left. I'm going to give you a couple of comments on skin depth. And what I'm about to say is not very scientific, could contain a lot of error, and it's a point of view, but maybe it'll help a little bit. Let me drop. And there's all kinds of ways of talking about displacement currents, displacement E-fields, and whatever, and the usual formula for skin depth. If you've been reading quite a few of the articles lately, you know that quite a few scientists doing tests with very brief laser pulses, laser optical infrared ultraviolet light, so light pulses coming out of a laser. If a nanosecond, some picoseconds, some picoseconds, femtoseconds of duration. They have been passing those pulses through various media, and some of that metamaterial media and fancy plasma and whatever that they pass those pulses through, on occasion, they manage to really slow down that pulse. Let me give you an example of that. You know that the radio signals traveling through air, 300 million meters per second. That is the so-called speed of light. That same radio signal traveling down you and my piece of coax cable, because of the presence of the polyethylene insulator between center conductor and shield, dielectric constant of around 3, velocity of propagation is 1 over square root of the dielectric constant, and you end up with a 66% velocity factor. there are materials out there I can lay my hands on called barium tetratitanate that you build dielectric resonators out of. Barium tetratitanate, some of that stuff has a dielectric constant of 100. That means you put a slab of that between two plates of a capacitor, and the capacitance just went up 100 times higher. Let me drop. You use that material with a dielectric constant of 100. You take the square root of that as 10. That means a radio signal will travel through that material 10 times slower. Not 300 million meters per second, only 30 million meters per second, and so on. You use higher and higher dielectric materials, plasma-like materials, as they're now experimenting with, and you can make a light pulse flow down through your medium, and you're observing it with your laboratory, moving at inches per second instead of millions of meters per second. They've been doing that for the last few years. So with the right kind of extremely high dielectric and or plasma-like materials, you can slow down a light pulse and look at it, analyze it, take it apart, whatever. Okay. If I'm now putting a sheet of metal directly across the end of a coax cable, so the center conductor and shield are grounded together because they're all in contact with a sheet of metal, we know that the signal is going to go down that coax cable, hit that sheet of metal, every bit of it reflects, and you've got a reflection coefficient of 0 dB. You've got an infinite standing wave ratio. Let me drop. We call that a short circuit, and that plate of metal is a damn good short circuit. And now if I start skimping, if I only put a simple piece of wire from the center conductor to the shield and I solder it across, that's sort of a short circuit, but it's got a certain amount of inductance. A piece of wire out in the air, very rough rule of thumb, 22 nanohenries per inch. Each inch of wire has, on average, in the vicinity of 22 nanohenries of inductance, just because of the physical layout. So you've gone from a nearly perfect short circuit to a slightly inductive short circuit. And with the available formulas, you can easily predict what percentage of the signal will reflect back with what phase angle. Okay? When you have that radio signal going through free space and it hits a flat sheet of metal at a nearly normal angle, or even at a grazing angle, almost all of it reflects. Almost none of it penetrates the sheet of metal. Does it not penetrate the sheet of metal because it views it as a nearly perfect short circuit, an extremely low inductance material? Does it penetrate only a very short distance because the velocity of propagation in the material is extremely slow? I could make a very rough analysis that I could say a piece of copper, a sheet of copper, has some characteristics of a material that has a dielectric constant that's nearly infinity, and therefore the velocity of propagation into the copper is an extremely small number, thousandths of an inch per second, so to speak. Could you make an analysis that way to figure out why the signal only goes in an extremely small distance? At 2 meters, at 144 megacycles, the signal going into your sheet of copper penetrates about 1/10,000th of an inch. Let me drop.
Comment.
And so it doesn't go in. And the depth, the word penetration, you got to be careful now. Remember I told you that once you create a radio signal, it goes everywhere. I can create the radio signal a mile away from your perfectly constructed anechoic chamber screen room, which has 100 dB tempest-proof mil-spec performance. And I go into that screen room and close the double-layered door with all those silver-plated finger stock around the door. I close the door, and all signals that go in there are now 100 dB weaker. They didn't stop. I just made them weaker. You can attenuate a radio signal. You can never stop it. The skin depth of penetration is where the signal has decreased to 37% of what it used to be, 1 over the natural logarithm, E. So 1 over E of signal strength left, we call that skin depth of penetration. You could have said, where's the signal 37% left, 33% weaker, 67% lost. That's the first skin depth. In the next skin depth, it loses another 67% again, or 63, I think 63%. So the signal gets weaker and weaker. It never stops. You build the best shield you can around your oscillator, and it's inside there with its own individual battery that's running it. You use the right kind of instrumentation on the outside, you're going to measure that signal. That perfect shield that you've constructed, 1, 2, 3 layers of it, you can calculate or measure how many decibels of attenuation. Let me drop. How many decibels of attenuation the shield created? It doesn't stop the signal. You cannot stop a radio signal. You can make it weak as all hell. You can attenuate the living daylights out of it. It never goes to zero. That's what's going on with Voyager. Voyager's way out there, 12 million miles, three times the distance to Pluto. And we're sitting down here listening to it. We've got to use some pretty serious hardware to listen to it. A 260-foot diameter goldstone dish in the Mojave Desert inside of Fort Irwin is where this great big dish is listening to them with state-of-the-art low-noise front end and a very low data rate and a phase-lock loop receiver with what is it now called? The Deep Space Network of NASA, a very well-designed system where you don't have to worry about the drift of the oscillator on Voyager because you're not using an oscillator. It takes every cycle of the signal that you send up, divides it by a certain number, and sends it back after modulating it. You're listening to your own signal coming out of that chunk of electronics. So there is no drifting oscillator. There is no aging crystal on board that's creating a frequency shift. And because you can count every cycle that comes back down compared to every cycle that you send up to the nearest fraction of a foot, you know the range to Voyager. To the nearest fraction of a foot, you can tell differential range when it's 12 billion miles away because of that method of operation. That signal will never disappear. It's going to get weaker and weaker at a predictable rate. It'll never disappear. You had a comment on this before I proceed. Go ahead, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's about a Cox. So in Cox, we have a differential power and a field that is confined inside the Cox. And a common mode power and the field is outside the coax. So let's say you have some ferrite core surrounding the coax that will see only the common mode power and the field. And there will be no differential mode radiation. So when we go to the skin effect, it splits short into the two conductors. The inner skin has a differential mode current, which will be the transmitter power, and the outer skin has the common mode current, which will be the current due to the impulse. Do you agree with that?
No matter how carefully you and I manufacture a piece of coax cable, which is flexible, which means there's one, two, or three braids on the outside, it has a predictable amount of signal leakage through that braid. The braid is a very good process of confining the signal. 99.99% of the signal stays inside the coax cable. That's why you and I use it as a transmission line. But nothing has infinite shielding. There's always a measurable amount of signal outside of the coax cable. On a good piece of coax cable at reasonable frequencies, that signal coming through the braid on the outside is 90 decibels attenuated. Well, when you're using the kinds of instrumentation you've got on an airborne Doppler shift radar, a velocity Doppler radar, where you can measure signals 150 dB down, 90 dB of shielding is nothing. That's a potent signal coming out of that coax cable. And now I can put ferrite, mu metal, other layers of braid, shielding boxes. I can put anything you want on the outside of that coax cable. I'm going to attenuate it some more, a predictable amount.
But do you agree that we're going to have a two current?
No matter how much you attenuate it, no matter how many layers, no matter how much magic stuff you put outside of that cable, the signal gets through all of that, it gets weaker and weaker. It never stops. You use the right instrumentation, and you think your triply shielded cable with mu metal and ferrite and everything else you put on the outside of it, and you tell me the signal is now not 90 dB of shielded, it's 140 dB of shielded. You give me the right kind of laboratory instrumentation, I will measure that signal for you. It never stops. You can attenuate it, you cannot kill it. Over to you, Wes. K2RIW.
Radio never dies, Dick. K2 CBV.
Give that man a cigar.
Okay, so I assume that we have two existence of two currents. One from the outside of the shield, one inside the shield.
I think the signal inside of the cable is going to dominate. The one that gets through the short, the flat plate at the end, is an extremely minor one by comparison.
No, I'm talking only about the shield. Not talking about any conductor, just the shield. The presence of the current that would be outside, and the presence of the current that would be inside, and to exit.
You and I talked on top of each other. Even that one can be shielded. So we haven't scratched the surface yet on what really is going on with skin depth. And we've run out of time. You guys have listened to TechNet number 1,554. And be kind to each other. Don't get as angry as those people out in Ronkonkoma. That anger is somewhat misplaced. However, the raw data they've been given is creating an awful lot of that confusion. I can see how it happened and what the corrective action is going to be to calm those frayed nerves. There's no glamour fix on this one. Not even John can solve that one. KC2WGB for some closing comments. K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, absolutely right, Dick. We're going to solve all the problems next week. We just delayed it a little bit. But I want to thank everybody for joining the net tonight. Very interesting. Good stuff. And if everything goes well, we'll be back here next week. Good night, Dick, Paul, and Wes. We'll see you again.
Very much for beautiful night, evening, and to action.
John, how much power are you running on your transmitter right now?
Let me give it a quick check. About 20 watts.
Wow, and I bet you're 70 miles away from me, and I heard you full clarity on the input. I think the band is open right now.
Probably. Let me bring it down to like 5 watts and see if you can see the difference. How about that, KC2WGB?
Sure, I can hear that too. Very slight amount of hissing, but I can hear that full copy.
Yeah, that's 5 watts. All right.
That'd be 2PR.
Papa Romeo?
Victor. Victor.
To Papa Victor. Okay. All right, I'll let you guys get back to enjoy your conversation again. My name is Ed. I'm down here in Levittown, Pennsylvania. And again, the call is N3, indicated airspeed, N3IAS.
N3IAS. Very good. Yeah, you can catch us on Echolink all the time. It's always there. So pop in anytime. KC2WGB.
KC2WGB, KD2AVU.
KC2WGB.
Good evening, John, and this is Tim, KD2AVU. I've got a question for you. I'm winding some inductors right now, so I want some of your opinions there.
I'll try to help you. Go ahead.
Thank you, John. Yeah, what's the, you know, I just want two inductors on the, let's see, it's the T50-61 material, ferrocore. I want like 12 windings on those two, and I'm getting about 7% of the, you know, deviation. I just measured it with a LC meter. Is that acceptable? Over.
Did you say 12% variation?
Negative 7%.
Oh, in my opinion, absolutely within specs.
Good. Yeah, I have the third one I did. Was actually the first one I made. It's within about 20% of the variation. So, you know, the first one measured like 8 microhenry, 8.2 actually, and the second one measured 10.9. So I just want another one just to see, what was going on. And the third one measured 9.9, so there you go. I guess I'll use the second one and the third one. Do you think it has something to do with the quality of the core? Over.
Well, the core will definitely affect your value, but what you can do is if you have two of them, wind two identical ones and check them. Are the cores removable once you wind it? Can you slide the cores in and out?
I can't do that. It's actually a ferro ring. You know, it's not a rod, so I need to unwind the magnet wire just to do it over again. Working on this Z-Match tuner, and these ferro cores are for toroid material, are for the SWR bridge. That tuner, over.
Okay, understand. Because I've had similar problems with sort of ferric rods, and it was material that I bought bulk.
Victor T to drop that on 8.5 from the input. Can you hear me this way?
KC2WGB, W2OA, still over the, on this frequency? KC2WGB, W2OA, still on this frequency?
Follow in 5. tonight at 8:30. This is the WG.